This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the book on BFM 89.9.
There was, I recall, still about 2 feet of water left to go before the hull of the boat settled on dry ground and we could walk about the park. We'd already polished off the Brie and Baguette and downed the Evian, but I was still hungry and characteristically said so. Monsieur Saint-Jean, on hearing this, as if challenging his American passengers, inquired in his thick Girondais accent if any of us would care to try an oyster. My parents hesitated. I doubt they'd realize they might have to actually eat one of the raw, slimy things we were currently floating over. My little brother recoiled in horror. But I, in the proudest moment of my young life, stood up smartly, grinning with defiance, and volunteered to be the first. And in that unforgettably sweet moment in my personal history, that one moment still more alive for me than so many of the other firsts which followed.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Buy the Book with me, Lee Chui Lin, and my fellow traveler through words, Sharmila Ganesan.
Hello.
So we've been wanting to do this for a little while now, and now seemed as good a time as any because, of course, the borders are somewhat reopened, or at least interstate travel is allowed. So our show today is going to be focusing on books that celebrate, focus on, perhaps even makes us want to travel.
So I think books and travel are so intrinsically tied together, right? Because even when a book isn't overtly about the idea of travel, just by what they do, I mean, I'm talking primarily about fiction, but largely books take you to another space, another place, another person's perspective on a life, a way of living. And so I think I'm going to stretch the point here a bit, but I think if you're an avid reader, particularly an avid reader of fiction, you can't help but also love the notion of getting to know new worlds.
So a way of living is such a great point, but also a way of travel. Because the thing is, right, like there are different types of travelers. And when you watch, for example, travel shows, travel documentaries, that is a certain style. But books allow you to embody a philosophy or the philosophy of the traveler that you're reading about. And I think that that is definitely a crucial point. I did, however, thought we could start by talking, ironically enough, about the problems that are sometimes inherent in travel writing. And I'm thinking about this very much from the perspective of how for a long time, the only people traveling and writing about it were white people. And this goes as far back as the 1700s, 1800s, and referring to people as dusky-skinned natives and the like. And how, you know, for a long time, that was the gold standard when we talk about travel writing.
Yes, and even for us, dusky-skinned people, that was what travel was, right? You read about yourself and your own world and reality through the lens of a white man, largely a white man. And there was something sort of, like when you think about it now, it's actually really weird, but some of it is really just practical, isn't it? For a long time, the only groups of people who had the means as well as the access to be able to travel and then to write and publish about it in a language that was accessible to the rest of the world were largely English-speaking white men. And I don't know, like I'm still unpacking, I think, what that does to my view of the world. And you know, when people say things like unlearning, I feel like this is a space in which I do a lot of, because I do find that as I've become older, I've moved very far away from wanting to read those kinds of travel books.
Yes, I agree with that. But I also think that there are some books that are not inherently about travel, but are about people making their way in new lands or just experiencing something for the first time, whether it's because they were correspondents, whether it's because they happened to be there during a war, for example, that those are books that I really, really love, continue to love. And so when I think about the places that I want to visit through the lens of those books that I love, sometimes the word unlearning doesn't even enter the picture because I'm like, you know what? No. There's something about the romanticism of how you're first introduced to a place that's hard to disassociate, even though I recognize that there are all these other elements about, well, who's writing this story and from what perspective are they doing so? The book that I'm thinking of in this respect is Graham Greene's The Quiet American, for example, which for many people is the book that describes Vietnam in a certain period of time. And I don't know. I really love that book, even though I know that it is a very narrow in some ways and very specific view of what Vietnam, what Hanoi is like.
So I feel that way about people like Paul Theroux, actually. Mm. And so often it's not actually a problem with the individual writer or even their individual works. I mean, sure, there are some writers who inevitably take on this sort of exoticizing lens, but I don't think people like Graham Greene or Paul Theroux or even someone like a George Orwell, who, you know, just by his essays and his experiences in the East, he brings such a refreshing perspective to this part of the world. I still don't think that they are the problem. So I think sometimes it's unfortunate that they get caught or sort of enmeshed in this larger idea of decolonizing, especially decolonizing travel literature. It doesn't mean that I want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I think it just means that sometimes it's worth looking at an alternative. I remember when I first read Maya Angelou's All God's Children Need Traveling Shoes. And it was, I think, literally the first time I've read a book by a woman of color traveling, because she was in Ghana. And I remember being blown away and thinking, wow, like I didn't even realize what I was missing out on until I read this book. But I agree with you that sometimes it's the particular introduction to a place by a certain writer that just sticks in your mind.
I have been reading Michelle Obama's Becoming just for fun. And it's, and also because I'm trying to bookend my year with the Obamas, apparently. And I've just gotten to the part in the book where they've gotten married and they're about to get married and they visit Kenya for the first time, which is, of course, where Barack Obama's father is from. And there's a passage in which she writes about recognizing a place as foreign, saying that this is the furthest she's ever been. And then she corrects herself almost and says, or recognizing myself as foreign in that place. And I was thinking about that because I think even now there is sometimes a propensity when writing about places, when travel writers write about places, to exoticize or to think about it in those terms and to think of the place as foreign rather than recognizing your foreignness within the place. And I think it is that distinction that for me marks the travel writing that I really enjoy.
So that reminds me of actually, it is a white man, but Bill Bryson, and the way he writes about himself in relation to the places that he visits. Sometimes that's just England or Australia. Other times it's places that are a little bit more foreign to him. And I like his writing primarily because despite the overwhelming whiteness that he represents, he actually positions himself as the outsider and he positions himself as the anomaly in that situation. And I think that's a very important distinction when it comes to travel writing.
I don't want to belabor the point, but similarly, a writer that I've brought up many times before on the show is Anthony Bourdain, who does exactly that and who is also such an intimate and descriptive writer that everywhere he writes about makes you feel like you are in fact there, and there, foreign and yet open to experiences. And I think that for me is my favorite. However, we have been talking about this very much through the lens of colonialism and of outsiders, right? Inherent outsiders to the culture coming to a place and writing about it. And we were sent a book recently, actually, that deconstructs this quite a bit. And it's called Return to Sri Lanka, Travels in a Paradoxical Island. And it's by Razin Sally. And he's writing from a completely different point of view, despite also being someone who is not, in fact, from Sri Lanka per se.
I found his perspective so interesting because in the introduction to the book, he talks about how he was born in Ceylon, but then it became Sri Lanka. And then later on, he actually leaves and he only comes back to Sri Lanka in his 40s, I believe. So it's a sort of both a belonging and yet diasporic lens. And because of that, it offers a way of looking at Sri Lanka's history, Sri Lanka's development, the different conflicts that it's faced in a very unique way. And he calls it a travel memoir, but sometimes I often found myself feeling like I wasn't even looking at it as travel. I was looking at it as almost a autobiography, a historical book. Yeah, it's an interesting space that it sits in.
Yeah, and that is actually an important thing to talk about when it comes to travel, which is to say that I used the word intimate earlier. And I think ultimately most travel writing, or the best travel writing, is actually intimate or offers an intimate lens, whether that is because it is a personal experience at the end of the day, or whether it's for this reason, where you're talking about somebody who is interrogating their own family history as much as they are thinking about a place, who's thinking about how they fit into a specific space, what this means to them and their heritage. And I think, and looking at that through the lens of, yes, the rolling tea plantations and the islands and the cities, but thinking about it very much through a, I start at myself, my family, and then it kind of keeps moving outwards to look at Sri Lankan society, to talk about societal structures, you know, all these different elements. And yeah, I agree. I think that the title suggests, or it's described as, a travel memoir, and there are definitely elements of that. But it is also, it's more memoir than it is travel, at least to me. But it does the thing that all travel writing should do, which is it makes you want to visit the place.
Absolutely. And I think, and this is an important point, it takes away the notion of travel as just a, what's the word? They use it for journalism, like a parachute experience, you know, the idea of going somewhere, taking a few photos, not really caring about the context and going away. But I think a book like Razine Sally's gets you thinking about context and roots and why a country is the way it is, which I think isn't a requirement for when you travel. But for me, I find that a very important part of why I enjoy traveling.
So that book is Razine Sally's Return to Sri Lanka, Travels in a Paradoxical Island. And we are taking a larger look at the idea of travel writing today, starting in some ways by deconstructing it. I do apologize. But after this, we are going to get into recommendations of some of our favorites. In the meantime, let us know, what are some books that you've read that made you feel like traveling? Or what are some of your favorite travel books and writers? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, and write to us, of course, at buythebook@bfm.my.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
I could, when I was told that the town had lost 3 miles, I felt a personal loss, mm-hmm. and tears. And that's very unusual for me. And when I went into the market, a very large woman started speaking to me in Ewe. Now, I spoke Fanti, and of course French, mm-hmm. and Togo, and that area had been a French mm-hmm. colony. Well, when I answered her in Fanti, which is a beautiful language from about 300 mm-hmm. miles away, I said, Auntie Mpocho, minti Fanti, and she just, I knew I was being blessed out. So I said, s'il vous plaît, madame, je regrette, mais je ne parle pas l'élevé. Then she was up. Then I spoke English, and she thought, you see, it turned out, she thought I was the daughter of a friend of hers who is also a market mm-hmm. woman, and that I had gone to the big city and done well, and I was trying to pass.
Hello, everybody. You are listening to Buy the Book with Lynn and Sharmila. And today we are traveling through words, or in other words, looking at great travel writing. So far we've touched on how travel writing itself has had kind of a problematic beginning. And now we want to look at some of our favorites.
Oh, I can't even decide which one to start with, but I think I'll start with something more local. So this is a book, but this is a book that I came across a few years ago, and it's one that I've gone back to a number of times. It's called Floating on a Malayan Breeze, Travels in Malaysia and Singapore, and it's by Sudhir Thomas Vadaket. And what I really like about it is that it's essentially two Singaporeans cycling around Malaysia and sort of drawing comparisons, contrasting Malaysia and Singapore. You get a lot of vignettes of what Malaysia is like, but at the same time, the very different trajectories that the two countries have taken, without necessarily saying, oh, this one's better, we should have done it that way. It also looks at things like race relations and how those have informed both countries. Again, I think sitting very much in that space that I've already said I enjoy, this idea of using travel as a lens to unpack something larger about a country and its politics.
Also being very light and delightful. I remember reading that book and I enjoyed it a lot, partly because... I mean, it's Malaysia and Singapore. It's always there's always going to be quite a lot of value mined from that alone. But also the tone and quality of the writing is very light. I wanted to give a shout out to the fact that I read this in a hotel, in the sense that the hotel itself had put the book in the room. And I just wanted to say that in terms of combining travel and writing and reading, that more hotels should do that. I really believe that more hotels should have books in their rooms.
That's a clever idea, isn't it? Because one of the things I used to do, which I don't seem to do very much anymore, is go to little, and this happens in more backpacker-oriented towns, I think, where they have little bookstores and then they have books that are from that place in that bookstore. And so you get to kind of read something that's from Yogyakarta or Yangon or, you know, wherever you might be. But the hotel doing it is a really clever idea.
So again, that book?
That book was Floating on a Malayan Breeze by Sudhir Thomas Vadaketh.
I wanted to talk about a book that is one of my favorites, but not necessarily one of my favorites to do with travel, because I actually think that it really demonizes almost the idea of backpack culture. And that is Alex Garland's The Beach. So Alex Garland has moved on now to film, you know, he's done Ex Machina. He's doing so many different and interesting things. But this was actually his first book, which is quite nuts when you think about it, because it has a very, very accomplished tone. And if you've only watched the novel, if you've only watched the movie, I would say it's good to read the book. It's a very good book because it focuses on backpackers in Thailand, you know, and the romanticization of going off the grid, of living on a beach, on an island, away from all the other commercial travel and the problems that emerged from that. But mostly, I love it because while, yes, it makes some parts of living or traveling to Thailand sound so amazing, I think it also skewers the idea of, oh, you've only been to Bangkok? Okay, well, you don't know the real Thailand then. Oh, you've only been here? Oh, that's so 10 years ago. And it really skewers that idea. It's been called one of Generation X's first great novels. And I will say that it is very firmly a Gen X book, but that's not a bad thing.
So it's interesting that you picked a novel, because I was actually going to suggest a novel as well. And it's not one that's unfamiliar, but I don't know whether enough people talk about it through that lens of travel. So I wanted to suggest that if you haven't already, that people read God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy, because, the story itself is, we do seem to be on a dark
path. Yeah, I pulled right a face.
The story itself is not the easiest, I admit, but its realization of Kerala as a space, its realization of Kerala and its cultures and what it looks and feels and tastes and sounds like, I think it's a really, really good example of both the best things about the state, as well as some of the possibly most difficult and complicated things about growing up in a place like Kerala. Again, not the easiest of reads, also not the most revolutionary of recommendations, but I think people don't usually talk about the book within the idea of travel. And I think it is actually a great example of being able to travel to a place.
Can I just say that I think India and Africa are among the hardest places to write about for travel writers, mostly because you fall so quick. Once in, if you're writing about Africa and you've used the word tribal, you know that you're going down a really strange path. If you're talking about India and the only thing you've managed to say is spice and color, once more, you're going down a strange path. And yet these are things that are actually part of both cultures. And so I think that it's one of those things where the earlier travel writers in some ways have ruined it for others to come, because it's so difficult to write about certain countries because of what we now know about how they've always been viewed.
Yeah, it's the classic thing about things almost having become a cliche, but it's unfair because those cliches have their roots in actual experiences. I mean, one of the most beautiful things about India is really the riot of colors. And even if you're talking about the cuisine, the variety of spices, but even saying it, I feel a little bit lame, you know?
That's the thing. I was just considering, I feel as if some countries are harder to manage when it comes to travel writing than others. And actually, Thailand, while we're talking about the beach, is one of them. India is definitely one of them. The continent of Africa, just really, I think a lot of people struggle with trying to phrase their experiences in a way that is going to be evocative and yet isn't going to be, like, to borrow your word, utterly lame. I wanted to mention a book that we've actually both talked about several times, but I think that it is a must when we're talking about travel, and that is Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities, because you just can't mention travel writing and the way that it, the way that travel, a bad word, travel inflames the imagination, without talking about Invisible Cities, which is basically an imagining of the story of Marco Polo and the way and the cities that he saw, whether real or imagined. And I think that before we set foot out the door, before we set foot on a plane into the car, Invisible Cities and the notion of travel that it holds is what we all hope for.
I love Invisible Cities. I love the notion of imagining cities and remembering cities and then talking about them and how in each of those iterations, they actually take on a different form. Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities is one of my favorite books of all time. I wanted to ask you, because the one thing that hasn't come up in this conversation, and I find that interesting, are travel guides. Because at one point in time, travel guides were the thing, right? I remember that. So I started traveling on my own post-internet age. And so the travel guides were almost sort of dropping off in popularity. But just before that, I dreamt of traveling with a rough guide or a Lonely Planet in my hand. I would look at them in bookstores and dream of the day when I could afford them and then sort of have one for every place I'd been to. Do you think they have a place in culture anymore?
No. I don't think that the aggregate style travel guide has a place anymore, because that is called TripAdvisor. And even TripAdvisor is falling out of vogue. So, you know, I just mean that there are websites that will do that for you now. You don't need to rely on a group of, 20 people when you could have a group of 20,000 telling you that, okay, no, this is where to go. I do think that the travel guide as seen through the lens of one person still has tremendous value, because if it's a person that you identify with or you read and you think, yeah, you and I seem to share similar interests or proclivities, then I think having that one person walking you through a city, that has a lot of value. But I don't know any more about the aggregate guides.
No, I agree. As someone who, used to long to own one, I do find that I don't see the value anymore. You're right that there's just so much information. And even the idea of having to carry a book around with you is so redundant. It's redundant because you have a smartphone or a device and you can look up everything you want. It does make me a little bit sad, though, because the notion of just reading about a restaurant or a park in a guide and then hunting for it around the city just feels so quaint now.
Yeah, I think to go back to what you were saying earlier about local bookstores, to me, travel guides or mini travel things as purchased in those bookstores, which the best ones do have, you know, when you go to places where the bookstore is like a staple of the city or is a major hub, they will usually have like a little map or something like that, like a local's guide to Santorini or what have you. And those, I think, are lots of fun. And those are usually, they understand, they, as big as like a 5x5 book, and that's it. Because most people don't want to be carrying anything resembling a hardback, which some of the Lonely Planets actually were.
Oh, yes. I would imagine that if you're traveling through Europe, having to carry 10 different books with you would have been half your luggage.
Yeah, that's the thing. I have a question for you before our final recommendations as well, which is, what made you want to travel when you were younger? Do you remember like one key book or story that made you think, I want to go to this place for the first time?
Okay, so not to a place, but to I actually avoided bringing this up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Only because I really think that my earliest introduction to wanting to travel was Enid Blyton. Firstly, all of the, you know, English picnics. And so London and England has this great hold on my imagination. But more specifically, I think it was the wishing chair and the faraway tree stories. This idea of kids going off on their own, kids going to an island and living there. Or the, you know, the this of adventure and the that of adventure. And just, I think that caught hold of my imagination very early on. And that really shaped my enthusiasm for wanting to just go out into the world.
You wanted a potted meat sandwich.
I did. And I wanted to go to the land of birthdays and, you know, climb a tree and meet Moonface. Yes, that was what I thought travel was. And maybe not that far off.
No, I understand it. I think that actually we haven't touched on this and we don't have time to. But the hold that England and London has on so many Malaysians speaks all the way back to what we started our show with, which is post-colonialism and how difficult it is to free ourselves from it. I was thinking actually about Greek mythology, because for the longest time, you know, I always told myself, like, I would save money, I would do everything in my power to make it to Greece one day, because I don't know, I wanted to be able to visit all the sites that were referenced.
100%.
Yeah. In the myths, I wanted to be at the, I wanted to be at the Acropolis. I wanted to be in all these spaces. And I have to say that when I did finally do it, it really felt like a culmination of something. And there's something special about that, of, I think, baby's first introduction to travel, right? Like, whatever that may be. All right. So to close us off, Sharmila, what have you got?
Okay. So I have a recommendation that I'm on the fence about, mostly because of the person separated from the works, right? I will say that if you want a great example of post-colonial travel writing, V.S. Naipaul is an excellent example. His works are so, you said intimate earlier, his works are both intimate and expansive. He gets at the heart of what it means to be a brown man traveling in a world that is largely shaped by white people. And his writing is just great. I find it a little difficult to read him anymore. But if you haven't read anything by him, I would think pick one up just to get a sense of what travel writing could be.
I have the polar opposite. I'm going to recommend Super Sushi Ramen Express, which is written by Michael Booth, an English travel writer. So again, we come all the way back to recommend an English writer. But I really enjoyed this book. It was a book that I read shortly before I visited Japan for the first time. And it helped me understand a little bit of the food culture that I was going to get into. It has a lot of the things that I look for in travel writing. It's funny. It's self-effacing. The people of Japan are never the joke. It's always, you know, Michael Booth and his family of adventurous to non-adventurous eaters. I also really love books about writing that are told through food. Perhaps my love of Anthony Bourdain is a clue to that, but I think that in many ways, a country's cuisine is a great gateway into understanding the place itself. And so Super Sushi Ramen Express is something of a love letter, actually, to Japan's food. He travels around the country, so it doesn't focus on any one place. He talks about the differences in each. He dissects the meaning of umami and the demonization of MSG. And all of it is very funny, very light. And I left feeling like I knew a little more and I was a little better equipped to go to the overwhelming world of Japan.
I've never read it, but now I really, really want to.
It's good. You'll want to eat ramen after, or sushi. We've been talking today about travel writing. We'd like to know who are some of your favorite travel writers? What are some of your favorite travel books? Or what's something you've read that made you want to visit a place? WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. Write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. Brings us to footnotes. It's quite a short one today, actually, but we just wanted to take note of the fact that the 2021 Booker Prize was just awarded, and it was to a South African author, Damon Galgut.
By the time she comes in through the back door, 133 minutes and 22 seconds have passed since she ran away. Four cars, including the long dark one, have departed. A single new one has arrived. The telephone has rung 18 times, the doorbell twice. On one occasion, because somebody has sent flowers that improbably turn up all the way out here. 22 cups of tea, 6 mugs of coffee, 3 glasses of cool drink, and 6 brandy and cokes have been consumed. The 3 toilets downstairs, unused to such traffic, have between them flushed 27 times, carrying away 9.8 liters of urine, 5.2 liters of one stomachful of regurgitated food, and 5 milliliters of sperm. Numbers go on and on, but what does mathematics help? In any human life, there's really only one of everything.
Yes, so I'll say up front, I haven't actually read any of the shortlisted books for the Booker Prize this year. A number of them look like things that I'd really like to read, though. And The Promise is definitely one of them, which is the novel by Damon Galgut that won the prize. It talks about, I think the lens through which a lot of these sorts of dramas unfold, basically it's about a family and a sort of a generational family, but also what the legacy of apartheid has left in South African communities. I don't know much more about it, but it's getting so much buzz. Galgut is actually a playwright as well, so he's known for writing very vividly. I'm quite excited to read this one.
Yeah, I also hadn't read any Galgut, and now I very badly want to read most of his works, but also this one in particular sounds very, very interesting. I'm a sucker for family stories, and also going back to what we were saying earlier about what families tell, what different entry points can tell you about a country, I think family culture, family values can also go a long way towards telling you about a specific society or a specific group within society. And this book, with its themes of apartheid and what you do with the things you inherit, actually sound very much like they would give you that kind of context. So some of the people who were shortlisted, though, included Patricia Lockwood, Nadifa Muhammad, as well as Richard Powers. And I will say that all the shortlisted books, i.e. the ones that will catch your eye the next time you're at a bookstore because they'll have the sticker shortlisted for the Booker Prize 2021, they all sound really interesting. Patricia Lockwood's one focuses on living in the internet age, of being a social media guru who has a portal to a world that is dominated by her existence. I mean, that alone, I think, sounds pretty great.
Patricia Lockwood is actually the one that I had looked forward to because I read her poetry. I haven't read, this is her debut novel, so I haven't read any of her prose. But I like her poetry so much that I think this is something I would definitely like to pick up. This year has been a bit odd because I haven't spent a lot of time paying attention to the bookers. I don't know whether it was just because I wasn't in the mood for the quote-unquote booker-style books. But I feel like after reading the shortlist and the synopses, I might maybe invest a little bit of time on them soon.
I take quite a long time to read bookers, I realize. We're going to be talking about Hamnet in an upcoming book club. And that is one that won, that made the awards round so long ago now. And I find that taking that break in between, what I lose in currency, I gain in perspective and actually wanting to read it. Meaning of me reading the book at the correct time, because it is the time that I wanted to read the book rather than, oh, the bookers are coming round, you know. Basically, you and I are not cut out to short list or long list anything like that. I'm looking forward to this year's winner and shortlist because honestly, they all sound very much like books that I would have wanted to read independently. You mentioned that you were looking forward to Patricia Lockwood, and I was actually looking forward to Maggie Shipstead. I've spoken before about how much I loved Astonish Me, which is one of her novels, and that book left me with that empty chest, breathless feeling. And so I'm excited to read her third novel, Great Circle, which is the one that was shortlisted. We've been talking about the Booker Prize, which has just been awarded to Damon Galgut from South Africa for his book, The Promise. We'd like to know, do you pay attention to Booker Prize winners? Are you excited about this year's winner or shortlist? You can let us know. WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio and write to us at buythebook@bfm.com.
Thank you for listening to this podcast.
To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.